If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin Underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. It's 40 years since Margaret Thatcher dispatched a task force to the South Atlantic in a bid to seize back the Falkland Islands from Argentinian forces. The resulting conflict cost hundreds of lives. Yet victory, when it came, was decisive, and it changed the face of modern Britain. On today's Everything You Wanted to Know episode, Spencer Mizzen sat down with Helen Parr to discuss the Falklands War. Helen is Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at Keele University, and she's also the author of Our Boys, the story of a paratrooper, which tells the story of the conflict and of her uncle, Dave Parr, who lost his life in it. As always with this series, our questions are drawn from a mixture of popular internet search queries and ones that you've submitted on our various social media channels.
Helen, the first question I'm going to ask you is one submitted by Joe Freeman on Instagram, and that is, what was the Falklands War? Now, I know this is quite a basic question, but it's one that I think will prove quite useful in the context of this discussion, because I guess not all of our listeners have a massively detailed knowledge of the conflict. So I was just wondering, in the space of a few minutes, if you could run through the Falkland War's chief milestones, please.
The Falklands War was a 74-day-long conflict over the sovereignty of the Falkland Islands, fought between Britain and Argentina between April and June 1982. So there was a long-standing dispute over the sovereignty of the Falkland Islands in Argentina. They're known as the Malvinas. And during the 1960s and 1970s, there had been negotiations between Britain and Argentina over the future sovereignty of the islands. So the Argentine sovereignty claim was rooted in anti-colonialism. The British hesitation about decolonizing the islands was that the island population very strongly wanted to remain in British hands. So there was a military junta in power in Argentina after 1976, and that military junta was in trouble. And on the 2nd of April 1982, the dictatorship, then headed by President General Galtieri, used force to occupy, invade East Falkland. So they landed on the island. There was a firefight with the small group of Royal Marines who were stationed there. But it was a very small group of Royal Marines. There was really nothing they could do. And the Argentines raised the Argentine flag at Government House. And that use of force changed everything. So in Britain, there was shock and real dismay that that Britain had allowed sovereign British territory to be invaded. The House of Commons met the following day, which was a Saturday the 3rd of April. And at the House of Commons that day, there was cross-party support for sending the task force in response to the Argentine occupation. The fleet started to be assembled over that weekend, absolutely enormous logistical effort, and it began to sail from Portsmouth on the Monday the 5th of April. So it was the largest assembly of force since the Suez Crisis, and it was the first kind of force of this nature in a generation. It obviously took quite a long time for the fleet to get to the islands, because the islands are 8,000 miles away from Britain. And while they were sailing, there were diplomatic efforts between Britain and Argentina, mediated by the United States, but no resolution was found. On the 2nd of May, a British submarine attacked the Argentine ship, the General Belgrano, and that was the episode with the greatest loss of life during the conflict. And after that point, it was really clear that there was not going to be a negotiated settlement, and that the conflict would be resolved by fighting. 2 days later, there was a retaliation against the British ship, the HMS Sheffield, which caused shock in Britain. On the 21st of May, troops began to land on the islands. And between 21st of May and the 14th of June, there was fighting during the land campaign. And on 14th of June, the Argentines completely surrendered and sovereignty of the islands returned to Britain. So it was a short conflict. There was some very intense fighting during the conflict, and it had a completely unambiguous outcome. The sovereignty of the islands returned to Britain. In the United Kingdom, the conflict and the successful resolution of the conflict enormously enhanced the political standing of Margaret Thatcher. The Falklands conflict really made Margaret Thatcher into the Iron Lady, with the image of Margaret Thatcher that most of us would associate really came from the Falklands conflict and the victory in the Falklands.
Thanks, Helen. That was a really great summary to get us going with the podcast. Now I wonder if I could rewind a couple of hundred years with a question from Roberta Alessandra, also submitted on social media. And that is, how and when did the Falklands become British territory?
So that's a really good question. So Britain, the British Empire and the Spanish Empire had a long-standing dispute over the sovereignty of the islands. There's a kind of contestation over who spotted them first. I think it was actually the French who spotted them first. And for a time, both those imperial powers maintained settlements on different islands. But the British sovereignty claim now really dates from 1830, well, not exactly the sovereignty claim, but the unbroken British settlement on the islands really dates from 1833. So on that date, a British warship expelled some of the settlers on the island. There was a kind of an itinerant group of shepherds or fishermen living on the islands. They were expelled by a British ship, and a British settlement was established. That settlement endured, so it developed an administration. It developed a sort of a settled population on the islands, and many of the inhabitants in 1982 were descended from those original British settlers from 1833. So, from the Argentine perspective, because you might wonder, you know, where the Argentine claim comes from. The Argentine claim was really rooted in anti-colonialism. So it's really connected to the birth of the Argentine nation, as Argentina came threw off Spanish imperial rule. And that was sort of in the 1820s, 1830s. And the whole idea of Greater Argentina, the territory of the Malvinas, as they call them, is really deeply rooted in that idea. So it's a very kind of deeply held notion in Argentina. It's part of the Argentine constitution now that the islands belong to Argentina because of that kind of history of anti-colonialism and the way in which it's tied to the Argentine nation. And for the British, the sovereignty claim comes from, well, you know, did Spain really ever have a valid claim to the territory? It was a sort of a British administration and a British settlement which was the most enduring there, and the people who live in the islands have ancestry with that settlement and very strongly want to remain British.
Why did they choose 1982 to launch their invasion of the islands? This is a question again from Robert Alessandra. What caused Argentina to invade when it did?
There was a military dictatorship came to power in a coup in Argentina in 1976. And that dictatorship had waged a war against the Argentine people. So there had been very significant civil conflict in Argentina up until that point. Tens of thousands of people had been disappeared by the military regime. And that use of the term disappearance was a deliberate one, because the regime murdered its opponents and often took their bodies and dumped them in the River Plate with the idea of expunging their memories from history. So there are examples where the children of who the regime would label as subversives, the children of subversives, the infants of those people would be, you know, the regime would kill the parents, take the infants and give them to families favourable to the regime. So you know, to be brought up by the regime. So it's a very brutal dictatorship. From their perspective, you know, they were protecting the integrity of the Argentine nation and waging war against a kind of subversive guerrilla campaign. Now, that war had obviously caused quite significant unrest and discontent in Argentina, and in particular, there'd been protests by the mothers of the Plaza del Mayo, who used to gather outside the presidential palace, demanding to know the whereabouts of the children of their children who'd been disappeared, and that discontent was very widespread. And added to that, there was hyperinflation in Argentina. So the discontent was spreading beyond those whose families had been directly affected by the war, and so the regime was in trouble. General Galtieri became president in December 1981, and his leadership was quite chaotic. I mean, he was notoriously very frequently drunk. There's one example where President Reagan phoned him up shortly after the occupation to kind of to talk to him about it, and he was incoherent with drink. So it, perhaps his judgment was not always the greatest. And they significantly miscalculated what the British response would be. In 1981, the British had removed, they had a Navy patrol ship, the HMS Endurance, which had patrolled around the islands. And people sort of saw that as a form of deterrent, you know, deterring the Argentines from thinking about an invasion. And that had been removed as part of the Navy defence cuts in 1981. So the Argentines kind of significantly miscalculated what the British response would be, and probably assumed that, you know, if they took force to the Falkland Islands, that well, maybe even to the extent that many of them believed that they, the islanders, would welcome them as liberators from British colonial rule. So I think that is why it happened then.
Actually, that point you just made, that takes us nicely on to our next question, which is from Franchise505 on Instagram. And that person asks, why were the people of the Falklands so loyal to the British? You just said that, you know, the Argentinians thought that they might actually welcome them onto the island, but of course they didn't. Now why was that? Why did the people of the Falklands feel such an affinity with Britain, which was, after all, 8,000 miles away?
It's a good question. I think, so most of the Falkland Islanders I've spoken to, they would say they are Falkland Islanders first and foremost, but they have an enormously strong affinity with Britain. So I think there are quite basic things. They're descended from the original British settlers. They speak English. They have English customs, they have red letterboxes, they go to pubs and drink pints of bitter. They're not Catholic, which is maybe sort of a significant cultural difference with Argentina. Probably in the 1970s, the fact that Argentina had been taken over by a military dictatorship definitely didn't help the negotiations. You know, Britain and Argentina had been discussing whether it could be possible to transfer sovereignty to Argentina, kind of in the spirit of decolonization. But once Argentina was taken over by a military dictatorship, nobody would really want to hand over people who maintain that allegiance to Britain to such a dreadful regime. So I think there's resistance there for a very valid reason. I think that in the 1970s, I mean, the islands have changed a great deal from 1982 till now. And in the 1970s, they'd become quite impoverished. So despite this great allegiance to Britain, the Falkland Islands Company, which owned nearly all of the land in the Falkland Islands, it was very much an absentee landlord. It hadn't sort of reinvested in the land. The people in the Falkland Islands didn't have a kind of great deal of control over their sort of economic fortunes. And there was probably in the 1970s a sort of sense of drift, and maybe a kind of assumption that gradually people would move away and the islands would become uninhabited. But certainly the people who lived there didn't want that to happen. They're very much invested in a British future.
Now, our next question comes from Leia Falcon 12, and she asks, which leaders played a defining role in the war? Now, we've talked about General Galtieri. So why don't we now talk about Margaret Thatcher? Obviously, you've touched upon her already. But I wanted to kind of ask you, what was the state of play politically and militarily in Great Britain at the outbreak of the war?
Yeah, it's a good question. So obviously, Margaret Thatcher is the really significant leader in Britain at this point. But it's easy to forget quite how politically divided Britain was in the late 1970s and early 1980s. And it's easy to forget how unpopular Margaret Thatcher had been. You know, she was, she took office in 1979. She was the first female leader of the Conservative Party. She was the first female Prime Minister. She was an oddity in that respect. There was very significant opposition to her spending cuts, not just from the political opposition, but also from within the Conservative Party. Unemployment reached 3 million in January 1982 for the first time since 1945. And there was a real sense that, you know, how could any government survive unemployment reaching that such high levels? So she really, her future was very uncertain in early 1982. And when news first came of the Argentine invasion, there was a huge sense of shock and of humiliation and of blame in a way. You know, how could Britain have allowed this to happen? And Lord Carrington, who was the Foreign Secretary of the time, he resigned. He resigned very, very quickly. And he shouldered the responsibility for the occupation taking place. So in terms of, you know, how things developed, Margaret Thatcher was in a position of quite a lot of jeopardy, really, because if the conflict had gone differently, she would have been in a lot of political trouble. So once Britain was committed on this course, there was a great deal of at stake, a great deal at stake.
So this is a quite substantial political gamble for her. What kind of reaction did her decision to go to war elicit from, you know, the political and military establishment in Britain? I mean, what was the state of the Britain's armed forces at the time? I mean, did a lot of people doubt whether this could be pulled off?
I think that the armed forces were not prepared for this kind of conflict. Nobody had really expected that there was going to be a conflict in the South Atlantic, 8,000 miles from home, over something as sort of isolated as the Falkland Islands. The British armed forces had been preparing for the Cold War, not for a kind of out of theatre operation. But the military reacted very, very quickly. So there's a story that, you know, on the evening when the British first heard that the occupation had taken place, that Admiral Sir Henry Leach, who was the head of the Navy, kind of turned up in Mrs. Thatcher's office in the House of Commons and assured her that it would be possible to assemble a task force over the weekend and that they could sort of set sail on the, you know, on the Monday, which indeed they did. But I think it's also important to remember that sending the task force didn't inevitably mean that there was going to be armed conflict. So that during April, as the fleet was setting sail, there were negotiations over the future of the islands. And probably one of the British hopes was that this kind of display of military force, you know, we said that Argentina had miscalculated, they weren't expecting Britain to react. So there was probably a hope in Britain that once Argentina could see that Britain was reacting, that they might revisit their you know, their stance. So there was a mediation mission run by the American Secretary of State Alexander Haig. But there was no diplomatic solution. Argentina was very, very reluctant to lose the gain that they had gained by force. So a diplomatic solution wasn't found. And then the fighting war started. Had Britain not been able to claim that unambiguous victory in the time frame, it could have been very, very much more difficult for a British Prime Minister.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
I was in Buenos Aires recently, and it's quite striking that there are murals on the walls of that people have painted that show the Royal Marines surrendering when the Argentine forces first arrived.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin Underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Now, I've just asked you sort of what kind of risk embarking on this war presented for Margaret Thatcher. But here's a question from Rob James, which kind of looks at it from the other angle. And he asks, what might have been the actual impact on Britain and its global standing if it had chosen not to try and take the islands back? What would that have done for the country's reputation?
That is a very interesting question. So in the House of Commons, after news of the Argentine occupation, there was absolutely cross-party support for sending the task force. And it's worth remembering as well that the leader of the Labour Party at that time was Michael Foote. He's on the left of the Labour Party. He was one of the founding members of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. But he is a staunch anti-appeaser. And so, you know, his message in the House of Commons, it was that, you know, Britain must not bow down to a dictator. And so, you know, both parties supported the dispatch of the task force. There was more division a bit later, because I think some people felt that perhaps Britain should have gone further to try to negotiate a settlement, and that perhaps the kind of, you know, the use of force wasn't worth, there were only 1,800 islanders, it was a territory far away from home. But I think once the fleet had been dispatched, it would have been very, very difficult not to go through with the action, because the only resolution that would have been possible, Argentina were not going to back down on their basic sovereignty claim. So the only kind of diplomatic solution that would have been possible would have had to have involved some kind of face-saving formula in the short term, but with an acknowledgement of Argentine sovereignty in the longer term. And so it very, very hard to do that without losing face.
Now, here's a question from Alex Plotkin, and was there ever a moment when it seemed Britain would lose the war? Now, as well as answering that question, I wonder if you could sort of give me your assessment of how the British Armed Forces performed during this operation.
So the British Armed Forces performed extremely well. It was a very, very difficult operation.
What were the main challenges?
Well, I mean, there's a basic challenge just of the terrain and the weather. It's very inhospitable. Once they're on the islands, you know, they're living outdoors, sort of facing the onset of the South Atlantic winter. The ships were, you know, in the waters around the Falkland Islands, under almost constant threat of air attack. So it was extremely a difficult kind of logistically and in terms of the kind of the climate and the terrain. The Argentine Air Force posed an extremely grave threat. There were many, brave and experienced pilots who did bomb several of British ships. Not all the bombs that they dropped were fused correctly, so they didn't all detonate. So there could have been more damage than there was. The Argentine Air Force didn't manage to attack the aircraft carriers. Had they managed to do that, that would have been a very, very difficult challenge for Britain. And they didn't attack the troop ships, apart from, you know, the dreadful bombing of the Welsh Guards as they were waiting to disembark from their ship in the bay at Fitzroy. The Argentine Air Force didn't manage to inflict losses on the troop ships before they landed on the islands. There are some quite perilous moments during the land campaigns as well. So, for example, when the parachute regiment attack Darwin and Goose Green, the plan was that they would be at the gates of Goose Green by dawn, but they weren't. They were sort of pinned back and completely in the open. So, you know, that's a very perilous moment, and it's only really because of the kind of spirit and determination of the soldiers on the ground that they win through there. The Scots Guards took very heavy losses on Tumbledown. Three Para took very heavy losses on Mount Longdon. So it's a difficult campaign. But because of the kind of, running up to the Argentine surrender, there's a coordinated night attack on the hills around Stanley, and that sort of the Argentines have to concede that their armed forces cannot continue.
Now, the Battle for Goose Green you just mentioned, and that's quite an iconic sort of event in this war. Can you just tell us a little bit more about that, please?
Yes, it becomes iconic because it's the battle in which Colonel H. Jones was killed. So he was the commanding officer of Two Para. So he was killed running up to a machine gun post. And people kind of question whether he should have been the furthest man forward, but there's no doubt that it was an extraordinary act of personal bravery on his part. The battle, as I said, the original battle plan was that they were to have arrived at the gates of Goose Green, where there's a civilian settlement, by dawn. But when the light came up, they were not really halfway there. They had to fight their way down this narrow isthmus between the settlement of Darwin and the settlement of Goose Green. The Argentines were dug into trenches all the way across the isthmus, and so they were drawn into some very intense and kind of close quarters fighting there. And once the light came up, it's completely flat. If you look at the terrain, there's a sort of a slight hill at Darwin, which was where Jones was killed, and then it just slopes gently down to Goose Green. So the Argentines at Goose Green, they could see them. So during the day, the fighting became quite chaotic, and then night fell again. And many of the paras who I spoke to said that that second night was really the worst moment for them because they didn't know what was going to happen in the morning, and they'd virtually run out of ammunition. So in the morning, the Argentines surrendered. The Argentines at Goose Green surrendered, and the Falkland Islanders who'd been kept hostage in the community centre at Goose Green were freed. But they, during that night, they didn't know that. They didn't know what was going to happen in the morning.
Now, you've got a strong family connection to the conflict, haven't you? I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that, please.
So my uncle, Dave Parr, was a private in the parachute regiment. So he was 17 when he joined the parachute regiment, and he was 19 during the Falklands conflict. So he actually went into battle at Goose Green, but he was injured very early on in that engagement. They came under fire from quite close quarters, and he was hit in the stomach. But when the medics came forward to tend to him, and you know, under fire themselves, they cut away his clothing, and they found that the bullet had struck his water bottle, entered his clothing, and come to rest in his belly button without breaking the skin. So he hadn't been badly injured. He had a bruised stomach, but he was evacuated from the battle and taken to the field hospital. He must have thought he was about to die when the bullet hit him. So he went to the field hospital, and then he came back to rejoin the unit after the Battle of Goose Green. He went forward with them onto Wireless Ridge, and unfortunately on Wireless Ridge he was killed. He was actually killed in by British artillery, which was brought down onto the position where his company was. So he was the only person killed in that incident, and that was just a few hours before the Argentine surrender.
So it's obviously a terribly tragic event for you and your family, and obviously as a result, the war has loomed large in your life, and you've written a book about soldiers' experiences of the conflict. So I wonder if you could sort of tell us a little a bit about what it was like, what the Falklands War was like to fight in for the soldiers on the ground, on both the British and the Argentinian sides.
So while I was researching the book, I spoke to quite a lot of former paratroopers and some other British soldiers. And one of the things that I found really striking was how central the parachute regiment was to their lives. So their pride in the regiment, and I'm sure it will be true, you know, for any regiment or unit with which professionally trained soldiers are fighting, their pride in that unit was absolutely very often at the absolute core of their identity. So I think it's important to say, you know, not everyone's experiences were the same. People experienced different things. But one of the things that really struck me was that what people experienced was seen through that lens of the regiment always. And, you know, when they went out to the islands, they, you know, paratroopers, they're trained to be confident. They really believe they're the best. And, you know, they're young men. You know, they don't think they're going to die. And going into battle, it could really come as a shock when they saw their friends killed or injured. And that sense of shock, I think someone said, you know, we thought we were invincible, but, you know, we weren't invincible. And that kind of, you know, that sort of, that feeling of, I don't know, a sort of insidious fear that perhaps they hadn't been as good as they thought they were, even though they won, you know, even though they probably couldn't have performed any better than they did. That's something that could, that could stay with people afterwards. And then, you know, recently spoken to a couple of Argentines, and again, a couple of former Argentine soldiers. And again, I think it's sort of something which both sides would share, was the real horror of seeing the casualties of war, and the how difficult it was to have to, you know, they were fighting in quite combined confined spaces, and having to see and to deal with the casualties, and sadly with the bodies, was something which many people on both sides of the conflict found extremely difficult to do at the time, and also it could be something which sort of lingered with them in the aftermath.
And I imagine the weather had quite a bit of an impact on their experiences as well, didn't it? Like you said earlier, this is quite a barren, inhospitable place to fight at times.
Well, absolutely. So the Argentine forces, you know, obviously arrived on the islands and then had to wait for the British to come. So they'd been there for quite a number of weeks before the battles started. And, you know, they were living outdoors. The lines of supply weren't always very good. So, you know, the Falkland Islanders sometimes reported young Argentine troops coming to the island settlements and begging for food. So I think by the time the British had arrived, some of the Argentines were finding life in the islands already very, very hard because of the climate, because of the terrain, because of that kind of, you know, well, because they were cold, they were young, they were hungry sometimes. For the British, you know, they taking pride in their kind of, which I'm sure the Argentines do as well, but taking pride in their kind of ability to cope with those quite extreme conditions. But nevertheless, you know, many of them said they got their feet wet as soon as they disembarked the landing craft. Sometimes their feet didn't dry out. Some of them began to suffer from trench foot. They're constantly living outdoors. It's dark. It was often snowing, sleeting, sometimes very foggy. During those night engagements, visibility was very, very poor. So there's no doubt that the conditions were extremely harsh.
Okay, we've had a question from C. Weaker, and that is, what was the aftermath of the war? How did the conflict change Britain? So we know that it ended in victory, and it's now remembered as an enormous event in British history in the context of the early 80s. But, you know, what did it do for the country as it progressed further into the 80s?
There's maybe three things to highlight here. The first is that there's absolutely no doubt that it consolidated Margaret Thatcher's authority. So first of all, in the Conservative Party. So there had been real doubt about her leadership prior to the conflict, but the victory in the Falklands enabled her to silence her critics in the Conservative cabinet, in the Conservative Party, and really to secure her authority in the Conservative Party. So it made her into the leader that people think of when they think about Margaret Thatcher. And that obviously, you know, it's uncertain whether it completely caused the 1983 Conservative election landslide victory, but it certainly contributed to it, and it contributed to a sort of a changed sense of mood in the country. So I think, you know, in that sense, its longer term impacts are obvious. It sort of it paved the way for that large Conservative majority in 1983, and for the sort of, you know, the subsequent political event, the miners' strike and so forth, that people think of when they think about the 1980s. But I think it's also important to be slightly cautious, because there was a change of mood, but it's not the case that everybody thought that this sort of that celebration was the best response to victory. So just as an example, at the memorial service at St Paul's Cathedral held after the war, the Archbishop of Canterbury issued quite a cautionary sermon where he sort of reminded people that, well, what he said was that nationalism is a false god, and armed conflict should never be celebrated. It should always be regretted. And our sort of the tone should always be, you know, never again. So there was kind of questioning of whether, you know, nobody could deny that this was a victory, and nobody could deny that this was a really important victory. But there was questioning of the tone within which, and I think perhaps the third thing that can be said is I think it did begin to change Britain's relationship with the armed services. So it's obviously, you know, it was a war that was very prominent in the public eye. And after the conflict, there were lots of sort of stories of individual servicemen, stories about individual families. And that sort of that individual attention that was focused on the armed services, I think, was new. And individual attention focused on the families of armed servicemen, I think it was something that was new. And it sort of it gradually began to encourage a sort of a more emotional attitude in Britain towards the armed services. Partly that's a sort of social thing, because people over time became more comfortable talking about the emotional legacies of conflict. And partly also it's just a change in tone of the way in which people thought about the troops. And you perhaps sort of saw that, you know, come to the fore more during Iraq and Afghanistan, when there was tremendous public support for the troops, but much less support for the government or for the state. And, you know, perhaps, and almost ironically, that change can be kind of traced back to the Falklands.
And a question from Jay Reynolds. That is, how is the war remembered and memorialised today in Argentina?
So that's also a really good question, and it's not a very easy one to answer, because the war obviously has a very difficult legacy in Argentina, because they lost it. And so to an extent, it isn't remembered. And certainly it isn't remembered as a defeat, which might sound strange. The war got rid of the dictatorship. Within a year, democracy had been restored in Argentina. So, you know, obviously that's a positive outcome. But you know, I was in Buenos Aires recently, and it's quite striking that there are murals on the walls of that people have painted that show the Royal Marines surrendering when the Argentine forces first arrived. So it's almost as if they try to imagine that the rest of the conflict didn't happen.
Finally, the Falklands today, to what extent is it different to how it was 40 years ago in 1982?
The Falkland Islands are enormously different to how they were in 1982. So the population has more than doubled. And they have become very much more prosperous. So in the 1970s, the economy was in real decline. But the conflict stimulated sort of economic reform. The Falkland Islands Company sold off the land so islanders could become landowners. And the sale of fishing licenses meant that they could take more control over fishing. And now I think the fishing industry has become sort of much more central, much more prominent to the economy. So it's a much more prosperous place. The island, as they've also, you know, taken sort of more control over their own self-government. So they, you know, they really emphasize they're a self-governing entity. And in 2013, 2014, they held a referendum which returned a 99.8% yes vote in favour of do you want to remain British or, you know, in allegiance with Britain, which is fairly emphatic indication of their preferences.
That was Helen Parr, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at Keele University. Helen's book, Our Boys, The Story of a Paratrooper, is out now, published by Alan Lane. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Collins.